This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We're going to start by talking about the political situation in Germany, failed coalition talks, chatter about calling fresh elections, people talking about the end of the Angela Merkel era. It's all setting the table for the potential fulfillment of some electrifying biblical prophecies. We'll talk with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this. It looks like Iran is putting the final touches on opening up a land bridge all the way to the Mediterranean through Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, with some gains it's making in eastern Syria. But when you look at what's happening here through the lens of Bible prophecy, you gain a different perspective. We'll talk with trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall to get some prophetic insight into this volatile situation. Another volatile situation is happening in Zimbabwe, where there's been a military coup against longtime dictator Robert Mugabe. We'll talk with a man here on staff at the Trumpet from Zimbabwe who grew up under Mugabe's rule, trumpet writer Anthony Chibatewe. He'll give us some perspective on this situation. And finally, if you've had a failure recently, stick around for the end of the program, and I'll give you a few words about how to bounce back. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Germany is in a political mess right now. Elections in September gutted the political power of the ruling party. It left Chancellor Angela Merkel with a politically impossible situation. She basically had one option to put together a coalition that could work. And on Sunday night, one of the parties pulled out of the coalition talks. So the strongest nation in the European Union has no government right now. This has huge implications for Germany and for Europe, especially viewed through the lens of biblical prophecy. What happens next? We can actually have a good idea of how to answer that question, thanks to prophecy. To talk about this, we have from our office in Britain, trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So we've been expecting this, right? We've been talking about the fact that these coalition talks were not going to work. This isn't a big surprise to trumpet readers.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most interesting and exciting things about this story is you can go back to the 1990s and find times where Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory has basically said, watch for this exact situation that we see right now. You know, watch for that to emerge in Germany. It's something that he was looking for, you know, just about every time there was an election. Watch for there to be this situation in Germany where you have no clear government or an unstable coalition. Then we saw in September, we saw the results of this election. We, right from the start, even from the very next day, were saying, well, watch for this kind of thing to emerge. Watch for these coalition negotiations to drag on and on. Watch for them to be inconclusive. If there is a coalition, it's going to be weak. It's going to be indecisive. And here we are.
Why don't we just talk a little bit about the prophecies that informed that view? This isn't just like exceptional political premonitions that we have. Why was Mr. Fleury saying that?
Well, the Bible goes into a lot of detail, obviously, about Germany, about events coming in Germany. And one of the main things it talks about, or big things it talks about, is a strong leader within Germany. Not only that, but it tells us how this leader is going to come about. So firstly, just the fact that there is a strong leader. The Bible talks about a king of fierce countenance. It talks about in Daniel chapter 8, the same Daniel 11 discusses some of these same prophecies. But just the fact that it talks about a king tells us a lot. Mm-hmm. This is an autocratic ruler. He's not somebody who's democratic. So that fact alone, when you look at Europe and Germany at the moment, really is a model of democracy, etc. That tells us there's going to be something big, mm-hmm. that there's going to be a big change in those entire political systems. And so that's what we've seen, especially since the financial crisis over the last 7 years or so. We've seen democracy come under threat more and more in Europe. You've seen the rise of extreme parties. You've seen nations like Belgium, like the Netherlands, go these extreme amount of times without a government, as just democracy kind of, or the traditional party system stop working, as people turn against the political systems that they have. And I think, you know, that's a small beginning of this. It's still in the small stages when we see that, but you're seeing movement in the direction that you would expect based on those Bible prophecies. But then there are more prophecies that get even more specific. So they talk not just about this king being an autocrat, they talk about how he comes to power as well. And they talk about specifically, they say he'll come into power through flatteries. They say they won't give him the honor of the kingdom. Daniel chapter 11 talks about this. And so you, when you study into those, the words, the root words used there, it's talking about a king or someone that comes to power in an illegitimate way, not following the normal political process. And so it's because of those prophecies that Mr. Flurry said, well, he could come in through a weak coalition. He could come in through some kind of post-election chaos or inconclusive government. And so the elections that we've seen and then the breakdown in coalition talks that we saw on Sunday have really set the stage for something like that to happen.
Merkel has said that she wants to hold fresh elections, that she would rather do that than get mired in a minority government. And you can see just how few and terrible her options are at this point. We've been predicting Merkel's fall for a long time. Somehow she's managed to survive to this point. But how much pressure is there on her at now? And is she going to survive this?
A lot of pressure. I've seen a few people. I mean, this isn't just the biggest crisis of Angela Merkel's chancellorship. The Telegraph, for example, talked about this being the biggest political crisis in 70 years, mm-hmm. In Germany's post-war history. So, yes, there are a lot of people out there saying that Angela Merkel is not going to survive this. I mean, you look at what the options are. You mentioned the minority government would be a pretty horrible option. If she went down that route, she would have to almost do coalition negotiations for every single piece of legislation that she wanted passed. And you've seen a lot of articles over the last couple of days pointing out how much Germans value stability, how much they like strong and stable government. And a minority government is the exact opposite of that. Mm-hmm. It means weeks of talks to get anything done. And then they normally collapse. Fresh elections with Angela Merkel at the helm, though, would probably just put Germany right back where it is right now. Mm-hmm. It would just delay things. Now, that's probably what's going to happen. The German president issued a call yesterday afternoon calling for the political parties to come together and form a coalition. I mean, just calling for that, though, doesn't solve the root causes that led to all of the talks failing in the first place, and so doesn't look like anybody's listening to him. So if you have if you have fresh elections, then they would be held probably February, and according to polls, nobody would have a clear coalition again. We'd be exactly the same as where we started. If anything, Angela Merkel's party would do worse than it did last time around. And so when you think that scenario through, well, it does look very unlikely that Angela Merkel can survive all of that. If she doesn't go right away now, and it is possible that her party could decide, well, if there's fresh elections, our only hope of doing better is getting rid of Angela Merkel and putting someone else in. Mm-hmm. But even if she can survive the next few days, or her party could also decide, well, if we get someone else in, maybe we have a better chance at coalition negotiations. But if she survives the next few days, well, unless she does really well in that election, then the pressure is really going to be on for her to resign again after that. And that's why Wolfgang Munchau, for example, just a veteran columnist at the Financial Times, he had an article saying that if you think all the options under the German constitution through, it's hard now to envision one in which Ms. Merkel remains as chancellor beyond a few months. So it really does look like, if not the end, the beginning of the end for Angela Merkel.
So let's get back to just talking about the broader implications for Germany. Mm-hmm. and for Europe. And again, looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, for Germany to, you know, there are a lot of people just talking right now about just how bad the timing is, considering all of the crises that are facing Europe broadly. Germany being the strongest nation within the European Union, its de facto leader, and a lot of Europe-wide initiatives that people are wanting to take, that there's a lot of pressure to take. In some ways, they're kind of put on hold while Germany is working out this domestic political crisis. Just talk about maybe what this means for Germany and Europe to be experiencing this at this moment.
Yeah, we have in our headline section on the website, we link to an article called "The Danger of a Post-German Europe" from Project Syndicate, that just says that this basically comes at the worst possible time for Europe. Europe's been through that massive crisis after the 2008, and this has been a slow rolling crisis that's provoked more and more pieces of economic problems, because Europe's fundamental economic problems aren't fixed. But then you had the election of Emmanuel Macron earlier this year, who wants some radical changes in Europe. People are getting more and more ready to talk about having these radical changes within Europe to take some radical steps. They were just waiting for the German election. They just thought, well, Angela Merkel will form a coalition. She'll come back out on top, and then we can get down to the business of transforming the European Union into the kind of union that can survive the turmoils of the years ahead. And now Germany is just stuck without a leader. If you have the election, if you have fresh elections and they're in February, and then you have more coalition negotiations, you're looking at March, April, maybe beyond. Germany still without a government. This article does a great job, the Project Syndicate one, just pointing at the amount of power Germany has already in Europe, that they really are the lead nation of Europe. So it's not just Germany that is left headless now. Mm-hmm. It's all of Europe. Any crisis anywhere in the next 6 months in Europe is going to heap tremendous pressure on Germany, because it's not just Germany that can't react. All of Europe can't react without that German leader in place. So it really piles the pressure on for Germany now to somehow find a strong leader to help them through all of this.
Right. You look at the kinds of crises that have been building. You see these terrorist attacks, and to this point, they've been fairly small. You know, they haven't had, like, say, a 9/11 scale attack in Europe, but you have the pressure coming from migrants in several European countries that are driving voters toward more of the far right parties or the more conservative type parties that are anti-immigration. You see a lot of pressures within Europe. You just think, if there's even one major incident that takes place here during this period of, we could really say it's a very vulnerable Germany, a very weak Germany, and inept and unable to respond, you could really see a major amount of pressure put on the whole process, somebody to emerge out of that. Just going back to the prophecies that you were bringing out at the beginning, that somebody basically says, look, the standard procedures aren't working. We need to take much more radical measures in order to bring commensurate force against some of these crises that are rising.
Absolutely. In so many ways, it looks like just the perfect stage being set for some of those prophecies to be fulfilled. And like you said, with these terrorist attacks, it's been a steady drip of attacks. There have been a few big ones, but even with each extra small terrorist attack, the pressure ramps up, and you've got ISIS, you know, showing pictures of the Pope beheaded, deliberately threatening terrorist attacks. There are so many ways that you could see some kind of major crisis coming up over the next 6 months. Say, you've got terror, you've got the state of the economy, and the potential for another 2008 style economic collapse, and that's something that Mr. Flurry's pointed to, that Herbert W. Armstrong pointed to as a possibility, as a major factor in urging Europe to unite. You've got Iran being even more pushy, and it really looks like kind of the Middle East building to some kind of decision point, and anything with, you know, with the tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and anything that happens there impacts Europe. You've got an aggressive, assertive Russia. You know, Europe sees that it's a more dangerous world right now. Mm-hmm. Europe sees that. They talk all about that when they get together and they stand for their pictures for about forming a military, like we were talking about on the show last week. So, you know, they see that this is not the same world that we were living in 10, 15 years ago. It is a more dangerous world. And you've got Germany going through that time leaderless. So, yeah, you could absolutely see maybe, say, the German president appointing somebody, or having, or the parliament voting, say, in an emergency to appoint an interim chancellor, this kind of thing. Exactly what we've been talking about from these prophecies in Daniel chapter 8, Daniel chapter 11, and just this style of leader emerging from Germany and then really being a powerful figure in all of Europe.
Listeners who want more information about these prophecies, where should they go?
Well, we've got the latest print edition of the Trumpet magazine. We talk about some of these, again, with those articles written in just the final days after the election. Those pieces of analysis are absolutely still valid, if not more than ever. A couple of articles there. We've got the German election earthquake on the front cover and Wanted, a Leader for Europe, that talks about both of those. Then we've got our article, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, that also goes through all of those prophecies from the Bible. It's a booklet by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry. And then we're right now working on a new trends article that hopefully we'll have up on our website maybe next week, about why the Trumpet watches a strong German leader, that again just goes in great detail and step by step through those prophecies, because these are all of what really stood out to me in working on some of that trends articles. You go to all of those prophecies that talk about a strong German leader, they also just about all talk about what happens after that, that this is leading into the return of Jesus Christ. It's leading into, you know, this leader is the last of the great European tyrants. Mm-hmm. So as you study into those background material, there is a huge amount of hope here as well. So it is really worth going to those booklets, going to things like A Strong German Leader is Imminent, reading that background material, looking at just the proof of Bible prophecy being fulfilled right now before your eyes. And then they all go on to talk about the hope that these same scriptures talk about as well. And really by seeing Bible prophecy fulfilled in world events, you're proving in that hope as well.
Outstanding. It's really electrifying to watch all of this happen, and so many of those statements that Mr. Flurry made in previous articles that we've been talking about for years. These scenarios are really leaping off the page, watching what's happening in Germany today. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this political quagmire in Germany and how this really does set the table for the potential fulfillment of some of the most electrifying prophecies in the Bible. Richard, we appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
For decades, Iran has sought to become the dominant power in the Middle East. Gerald Flurry's feature article in the January 28 Trumpet magazine is about how Iran has become the king of the region, the king of the South in biblical terminology. One aspect of Iran's strategy has become clear in recent years, and that is to build what is effectively a land bridge to the Mediterranean, an arc of influence that runs through Iraq, through Syria, through Lebanon, all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. And a key part of that bridge is in the eastern part of Syria. This is an area that's been under contention between Islamic State forces, American-supported forces, and those of Iran, the Assad regime, and Russia. Well, it appears this situation may be coming to a conclusion in Iran's favor. To talk about this, we have from our office in Jerusalem, Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
We were talking about this strategic area in Syria a few months back and why Iran is really seeking control here. Just bring us back up to speed on why this area is so important and then what's happening there right now.
So this area on the Iraqi-Syrian border was really the central, the command structure for the Islamic State, this area. This is where most of their men were held, and it's out from here, from eastern Syria, that they spread out into Iraq and further westward into towards Lebanon. And as the Islamic State has shrunk in power over the past year and a half, gradually they've retreated all the way back to their capital city in Raqqa, which is in eastern Syria, and then even continued further once Raqqa fell last month, back a little bit further south along the Syrian border. And what we've been talking about for some time now is Iran's grab of the territory that the Islamic State loses, and how Islamic State's loss has generally been Iran's gain, whether it be through their proxies in Iraq or whether it be through the Syrian regime in Syria. It doesn't matter. Generally, what we've seen is pro-Iranian forces gobble up that territory. So now what we're looking at is this last vestige of the Islamic State, which is crumbling right now, if not this week. It looks like the Islamic State might have lost its any contiguous territory at all through these areas. So now we're talking about this final area. Who's that going to? And it looks like Iran has really stepped up its offensive to ensure that it maintains control of this territory between Iraq and Syria.
Okay, so the specific position that the Islamic State is losing, can you just describe the most recent events there and what's happening in that specific area?
Right, so we're talking about, again, eastern Syria, and it's southeastern Syria that is this last area to fall from the Islamic State. The Shiite-backed militias, they are the ones that took this, I think it was last week, this town of Abu Kamal. This is right on the border between Iraq and Syria. On the Syrian side, on the Iraqi side, you have Al-Qaim. But then the Islamic State ambushed the Shiite fighters, push them back. But then just this week, we've had the Iranian-backed forces take this final strategic roadway. That's what it is. You've got a massive road that comes up from Baghdad up through Hit, a little through central Iraq, going across, and it meets up with another major roadway that links southeastern Syria all the way across eventually to Palmyra and then across to Damascus. That's why it's important, this roadway. And to prove how important this was to the Iranian regime, back about a month ago, we had a sighting of their Quds Force general, the Iranian general Qassam Soleimani, just north of this area of the town of Abu Kamal. And then on Tuesday, there were pictures that emerged of Soleimani himself in Abu Kamal in the victory parade to show that we have finally conquered this part of the territory, which is allowing us to establish this land bridge. And they're not shy about their goals, the Iranians. They never are. They tell the world what they intend to do. And just this week in the IRGC's paper, called the Javan, they published a piece saying the liberate quote, this is this week from the IRGC, which is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, basically the army that answers directly to the Ayatollah himself. And then the leader of this force is Soleimani. Anyway, their paper said the liberation of Abu Kamal means the completion of the last ring of the resistance land corridor, based on which Tehran would have land access to the Mediterranean Sea and Beirut, which is rare in Iran's several millennia-long history. So they're saying it's done. It's complete. We can now reach from Tehran all the way across to the Mediterranean Sea.
Now, it's interesting that this is coming out at the same time that all of this unrest is happening in Lebanon. And we've been talking about just how really Lebanon is kind of in play right now. As much as Iran would like to consider that piece of the this land bridge a secure element, it seems like there might be some uncertainty there, given the strong moves that Saudi Arabia is making to try to retake it. But setting that aside for a moment, maybe just you can explain, why is it so important strategically for Iran to have this land bridge, and what does it mean for Iran to be able to carry out its ambitions in the region?
Right. So this land bridge, it has numerous pathways it could take. There's three main roads that go across, that connect from Iraq into Syria. This is the central one, the central roadway. The one further in the south, the United States controls that right now. Further in the north, you have the Kurds that are there on the Syrian side, and the Iran controls the Iraqi side. So this is one of the potential roadways. It's really important for Iran, if they're going to dominate this area, to have land access across, not because they don't really have the best air force. It's hard for them to ever bring in personnel, weaponry, unless it is across land on convoys. And so if they're going to really push, well, be able to expand their power base across this region, they need road corridors. So that's why it's absolutely critical for them to have this. What's interesting about this one in particular is because just 25 miles north of it, you have currently U.S. allies still fighting there, and you have and even south of this one, you have a U.S. Army base right there on the Syrian side that Iran has tried to push the United States out. The United States hasn't left there yet. And so right now it's actually is a really big decision time for the United States as well, because they are in a position to stop this. They could stop this if they wanted. Give it another month or two, maybe not. But the United States, if it empowers the Kurds, could actually stop this completion of this land bridge. And we'll see if that happens. It is interesting just looking at this, because we talked about Lebanon and Saudi Arabia trying to pull Lebanon away from Hezbollah or Iranian hands. I think eastern Syria is in play just as much as Lebanon is, because Hezbollah, the Damascus regime, or the Syrian regime under Bashar al-Assad, is not going to be as effective unless Iran has a land corridor to help it in the event of war. Iran needs this. This to cut it. So really, if you're going to be the United States, or if you're going to be the Syrian rebels, or if you're going to be any other power that is interested at stopping Iran's dominance to the Mediterranean Sea through this region, eastern Syria is very important to you strategically.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the United States having a decision point here. We also were talking about just how interesting it is, especially given biblical prophecy, that France has inserted itself into the situation with Lebanon. Is there any indication that European nations are looking at this and saying, well, we need to check Iran's spread in this theater?
They haven't yet, but any strategic planner, as far as trying to stop Iran's rise across through this area and control, has to be looking at eastern Syria. There's been a number of reports, even in the Washington Post, I think it was yesterday, in Israeli papers, numerous reports about this decision point for the United States is who they're looking at mainly, because the United States has been the one that generally tries to stop Iran. The Europeans haven't been that invested in it to this point. And the fact that you have such a strong ally of the United States that would be willing to fight. The problem that we have right now is that the Kurds that are doing the fighting on this Syrian side, they are looking to the example of what happened a month ago in eastern Iraq, when you had Kurdistan, the Iraqi Kurds that were controlling this area of Kirkuk. This is basically the oil breadbasket, if I can call that, of Iraq. And the United States didn't put up a fight when the Iraqi army and the Shiite militias charged into that. Well, Eastern Syria is very much the same. This is the breadbasket of oil and gas of Syria. Mm-hmm. And right now, the Syrian regime wants it, Iran wants it, and they, especially the North, but right now the Kurds control that. So the Kurds are asking, will the United States back us up if we try and push the Iranian regime out? I think the Kurds would be willing to find another ally that could be Europe. If France is serious at stopping Iran's hegemony over Lebanon, they have to be looking at cutting the supply line to Hezbollah from Iran. Right. And Eastern Syria would be where you would do that.
Well, that's an excellent point. And just looking at this from biblical prophecy, that's what's been informing the way that we've been looking at the situation in Lebanon. You have to have a similar analysis, really, in looking at what's happening in Syria, just because the outcome, as far as what the indication within biblical prophecy, is that we're also going to see this Iranian-Syrian alliance severed.
Yeah, and I think that is exactly why we're watching this closely. It's because right now, where you have the United States and the Kurds and you have Iran, and they're just completing this land bridge in this thin little slither right now with Soleimani right there, we could say, based on what happened last month, the United States is going to bug out. They're not going to fight here. And maybe they will. But it's interesting because Bible prophecy puts or really does mark this Syrian-Iraqi border, this territory of eastern Syria, as a dividing line between an ally of Iran or Iranian-controlled area and the allies of the Psalm 83 alliance. Syria and Lebanon are not going to be allied with Iran. That means that the Iraqi-Syrian border, somewhere in there, it might not be the exact border, but it is in eastern Syria, we are going to see a fault line. Mm-hmm. Iran's not going to give up this territory. They will not do it. So somebody is going to have to come in there and say, no, you're not going to control this territory, and cut off their land bridge from happening. Most forecasters are not saying that anyone has the guts right now or the force or the motivation to do that, not even the United States, based on what they've done from last month. And yet Bible prophecy says somebody is going to stop Iran from making this land bridge something that lasts.
Yeah, it's fascinating to have that overview and looking at the situation as it's developing. You have a completely different take given the outline that biblical prophecy gives to us. If somebody's interested in just learning more about that, studying into it more, do you have some places that you could direct them to?
Yeah, I wrote about this fight about 6 months ago, 5 months ago. It's called the Eastern Syrian Battleground. I believe that's what it's called. And you can write for that. But really, that analysis was informed by a piece written by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, back in 2012, entitled How the Syrian Crisis Will End. And he forecast 5 or 6 years ago that Syria is going to fall out of Iran's hands, and Eastern Syria is where it'll happen. So you can read one of those two articles.
Excellent. We appreciate that, Brent. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about this strategic battleground in eastern Syria. All of these players, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, the United States, Europe, have a vested interest in there, even Russia. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Brent, we appreciate your time.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Robert Mugabe ruled Zimbabwe for 37 years. Now that rule has come to an end. A military coup recently, and now news that he has resigned. And we're just going to talk with one of our trumpet writers, Anthony Chibaderwe, who is a native of Zimbabwe, grew up under the rule of Robert Mugabe, and he's here in the studio to talk with us. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you. We want to take advantage of the experience that you have here. I just want to start by talking about your growing up under Robert Mugabe's rule. 37 years in power, that's your entire lifetime. You're, what, 32 years old?
Yes.
Okay, so what was that like? And just when you think about him and what he represented, maybe you could just share your personal thoughts on that.
Yeah, President Mugabe was the only president that we knew, and growing up in Zimbabwe, we felt like everything was working fine in the country. The economy was doing well. I understand that at one point, the Zimbabwean dollar was stronger than the U.S. dollar. So I think it's primarily because of that a lot of people were not that much interested in politics. I'm talking about the average individual. As long as you had enough food, as mm-hmm. long as you could attend school, which we did without a problem, most people didn't care too much about politics. And in fact, a lot of people were maybe fairly somewhat ignorant of politics and what was going on, and even the history of Robert Mugabe and how he came into power. In 1980, when Zimbabwe gained independence from Britain, he did come out and say, okay, let's leave the past behind us. So anyone who speaks that kind of language is embraced by a lot of people, and that's what he did. And that tends to hide some of the negative things, the bad things that might be going on. But for the most part, that's the impression that we had of Robert Mugabe, someone who wanted to reconcile with the West and improve relations. And it seems like for some time it did work. Hmm. But a lot of his policies regarding the economy were not going so well. And it was only a matter of time until it started impacting the country in a very negative way. And that was around the year 2000, when inflation was skyrocketing, and President Mugabe started using politics to not only cement his power, but also hoping that he would improve the fortunes of the economy. He started the controversial land redistribution program. He said that it's one way of addressing the injustices of colonialization, where you had the minority white people in Zimbabwe owning most of the farmland. He felt like that's an injustice that now needed to be addressed. So he started that and pushed for that. And that was one way for him to cement his power, especially with the majority Zimbabweans, black Zimbabweans, who found themselves in an economy that was failing.
I just wanted to read a quote from Mugabe's biographer, Martin Meredith. He's written quite a few books about Africa. He said, by the mid-1990s, Mugabe had become an irascible and petulant dictator, brooking no opposition, contemptuous of the law and human rights, surrounded by sycophantic ministers, and indifferent to the incompetence and corruption around him. His record of economic management was lamentable. He had failed to satisfy popular expectations in education, health, land reform, and employment, and he had alienated the entire white community. Yet, all the while, Mugabe continued to believe in his own greatness, isolated and remote from ordinary reality, possessing no close friends and showing clear signs of paranoia. He listened only to an inner circle of conspiratorial aides and colleagues. Whatever differences occurred, he attributed to old enemies, Britain, the West, the old Rhodesian network, all bent, he believed, on destroying his revolution, quote unquote. How much does that resonate with you?
That's a very good summary of what happened in Zimbabwe, especially in the 80s and in the 90s. You know, by the late 90s, a lot of people, like you said, were disappointed. They felt let down. And there had been talks that Mugabe had been planning to retire in 2000, but because a lot of people were expressing their disappointment, he wanted to try to please some of his supporters by getting back into the land redistribution program, but he just did it in a very radical manner. He wanted to use that to gain as much support as he possibly can, telling his supporters that they could seize white-owned farms and get them for themselves, and got them to believe that it was rightfully theirs in the first place. And of course, that created a lot of problems. Those who supported him loved that and they went for it, and those who opposed him felt like he just needed to go. So the opposition against Mugabe just increased a whole lot more. People who were not previously interested in politics, they became these staunch opponents of Robert Mugabe. And Robert Mugabe, instead of stepping down in 2000, he just wanted to remain in power to make sure that he saw it through, I guess, to preserve his legacy, or to make sure that he goes out with something to try to show, at least to some of the native Zimbabweans. But that created a huge rift between Zimbabwe and Britain. Zimbabwe had a fairly good relationship with Britain. A lot of Zimbabweans just wanted to go to Britain. That's pretty much what most people cared for outside of Zimbabwe. They wanted to go to Britain, and there had been these good relations. But because of this land distribution program, Mugabe was demanding that people take over farms, and Britain was supposed to be the one to compensate those white farmers who lost the land. And it was just so chaotic. And yes, there was that rift that was created between Zimbabwe and Britain and the West in general. And that, of course, made the economic situation even worse because of our dependence on Britain and on the West. And of course, the West responded with sanctions against Mugabe, and that made things even worse. It forced Mugabe and his supporters to try to look more towards countries like China, which would disregard human rights issues, the chaos that was taking place. And ever since, China has had a strong influence in the country, as Andrew wrote about in a Trumpet article recently. But yeah, as far as the economy, it's just been downhill since 2000.
Mm-hmm. So let's just go ahead and transition to more of what's been happening here in the last couple of weeks. Maybe you could just talk us through what's happened there, and then the announcement that he made.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 2 weeks ago, President Mugabe fired his vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, for what the government described as disloyalty, disrespect, deceitfulness, and unreliability. Among other things, that move to fire his vice president was a ploy to eliminate a major obstacle in Grace Mugabe, that's the first lady. Grace Mugabe wanted to succeed Mugabe.
And she's considerably younger than her husband and presumably could take power for quite some time.
Yes, that when Mugabe fired Mnangagwa, it was seen as a move to just ensure that Grace can succeed her husband without any much opposition. And that really was something that a lot of people just couldn't accept. Grace Mugabe really is not temperamentally fit to be president. Mm-hmm. And I said that very respectfully. For one, she's wanted in South Africa for assaulting one of her son's girlfriends. And she's used foul language in political rallies, and she's that kind of person that almost all people would rally around in opposing. That included people in the ruling party. It mm-hmm. included people in the military. It included people in the opposition. So what you've been seeing, what has been happening these past 2 weeks is primarily because a lot of people are just opposed to Grace Mugabe. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot more to it than just Grace Mugabe, obviously. So Mnangagwa was fired, and Mnangagwa had very strong connections with the military. And so you had last week this military coup. The military didn't call it a coup. They put Mugabe under house arrest and say that we're just trying to go after the people around Mugabe who are very corrupt, which was very vague. But there is an understanding that it's not just Grace Mugabe that had to go. It also was Robert Mugabe who had to go. And he did finally resign. But all the drama that has been taking place with the negotiations with the army, it seems like it was orchestrated in such a way as to present this to everyone, especially everyone outside Zimbabwe, to present this as something that wasn't unconstitutional. They wanted it to look like something that's not a military coup, mm-hmm. because Africa has had a lot of those, and they haven't gone very well, and everyone has opposed a military coup. So, and there was going to be a lot of opposition had there been an official military coup.
So they were concerned about the optics, but essentially that is what has happened here. And it seems like you're talking about just how much unanimity there was in supporting this kind of a move. But you see that even with countries like China, you mentioned that they seem to be going along with this transition to a new government. Now Mugabe himself has said, okay, he's going to resign. He's relinquished this hold on power. So when you're looking at this just from a biblical prophecy standpoint, what do you see as kind of the main thrust, or the main angles that make this prophetically relevant?
Bible prophecy does indicate that American and British influence in the whole world is going to decline, and Zimbabwe is a very good case study for exactly that happening. Over the 37 years of Mugabe's rule, we have seen America's influence decline, British influence decline, and we've seen China's influence growing in some of these countries like Zimbabwe. And that's also something that the Bible has prophesied. And another thing that you witness in this crisis in Zimbabwe is just there's a lack of leadership in this whole world. Mugabe is gone, but who's going to replace him? Mm-hmm. There are fears that Emmerson Mnangagwa could be even worse. So that's just demonstrate how inept human governments are in leading people. The same people who have removed Mugabe are the same people who kept him in power all these 37 years. So that's also something that the Bible talks about. Crisis in leadership, dictators, tyrants, in many different parts of the world, tyrants who thankfully will soon be replaced by a government that rules with love, and that government is God's kingdom, and thank God it's almost here.
Well, that's a good place to finish. We appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Anthony Chibadwe about the fall of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. Anthony, we appreciate your perspective.
Good to be here. Thanks.
It it's time for today's last word.
Have you had a discouraging setback recently? You work really hard on that presentation at work and the plan is rejected. That home improvement project that seemed simple turns out to be tricky, time-consuming, and a lot more expensive than you thought. You strive to meet a challenging goal and you fall short of attaining it. Well, what do you do when you smack face first into failure? Do you get negative and bitter? Do you allow discouragement to overwhelm you? Do you give up? A whole lot of people do. Letdowns happen to us all, and how we respond is what's really important. I recently encountered this old poem that speaks to the need to keep life's struggles, obstacles, and failures in perspective. "'Tis a lesson you should heed, try, try again. If at first you don't succeed, try, try again. Then your courage should appear, for if you will persevere, you will conquer, never fear. Try, try again. Once or twice, though you should fail, try, try again. If you would at last prevail, try, try again. If we strive, 'tis no disgrace, though we do not win the race. What should you do in that case? Try, try again. If you find your task is hard, try, try again. Time will bring you your reward. Try, try again. All that other folks can do, why with patience should not you? Only keep this rule in view. Try, try again." Why try again when it's so much easier to sigh again or cry again and just give up? The reason is that failure is part of learning. Nobody is an instant expert. If you're pushing yourself, if you're doing hard things and learning and growing, you're going to fail. If something is really worth doing, it's going to take time and effort and failure to learn it. If you only do what comes easy to you and what you're already good at, you're going to be stuck in mediocrity. If when you fail, you give up, you'll never grow. That was true when you were learning to talk. It's also true as you're learning to deliver a speech. Wendell Phillips said, "What is defeat? Nothing but education. Nothing but the first steps to something better." There's something magnificent about watching a baby first learning to walk. This tiny human is amusingly awkward, on the edge of disaster at all times, repeatedly falling on his diaper-padded tushy, and yet he's happy, wide-eyed, exhilarated, acting like these unsteady steps are spiking his adrenaline like the final strides up the peak of Everest. Now imagine the baby who fails time and time again, trying to walk, and finally gives up in exasperation. And now he's 45 years old, still crawling on his hands and knees. "Yeah, I tried walking. It's not my thing. I've got no talent." That would obviously be pretty awkward. Herbert W. Armstrong wrote a booklet called The 7 Laws of Success. We'd be happy to send you a free copy. It's a great little booklet. The 6th of these 7 laws is perseverance. This booklet says 9 in 10, at least once or twice in a lifetime, come to the place where they appear to be totally defeated. All is lost, apparently, that is. They give up and quit. When just a little more determined hanging on, just a little more faith and perseverance, just a little more stick-to-itiveness would have turned apparent certain failure into glorious success. Learning to gracefully handle disappointment and to bounce back from failure, that's going to make you a lot more successful at a lot more things in your life. The person who remains positive, learns from his mistakes, applies the lessons of a failure, and charges forward for another attempt, that's the person who ultimately nails it. Proverbs 24, verse 16 is a wonderful proverb to remember. It says, "For a just man falls 7 times and rises up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief. Now, everybody falls, but when the wicked fall, they don't get back up. When the righteous fall, they refuse to give up. They rise to their feet and keep moving forward. It says they fall seven times and rises up again. Seven times is an expression that means over and over, again and again. Psalm 145 and verse 14 gives another scriptural promise to keep in mind. It says the Eternal upholds all that fall and raises up all that be bowed down. When you fall, God will revive you. When you're discouraged, He will pick you up and encourage you, just like a parent who is excitedly helping his toddler learn how to walk. So, you failed. Don't be discouraged by the fact that you're human like the rest of us. Think it through, get counsel, learn what you can from the mistake. Rise up, lift your chin, and move forward. The harder you work for something, the sweeter it'll be when you achieve it. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for this edition of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much to my guests, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Anthony Chibaterwe. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Leonardo da Vinci. I've been impressed with the urgency of doing. Knowing is not enough. We must apply. Being willing is not enough. We must do. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.